This is Military Mondays with Major David Katz.
Major David Katz, a very, very good morning. Welcome to Military Mondays. It's just after 8:30. Are you happy with your music?
Could I offer some constructive criticism?
No, David, you really can't.
Have you not heard this?
I would just.
Hold on.
It's so serious, Military Monday, that I would expect an intro with more gravitas, you know, maybe Toccata and Fugue.
What, for yours?
Or Beethoven's Fifth or something. Yeah. Sorry, maybe it's a bit too flippant, some of the stuff that you...
What, like this? You think this is flippant?
This is Military Mondays with Major David Katz.
Yes.
I'm talking about the intro to the intro. Some of the music that comes on 10 minutes before then doesn't set the tone for what we're going to talk about.
Oh, yeah. So you're now going to dictate the mood
set the ambiance.
Because you're invited on for a few moments. Right. No, I can see that working, Zanati. Can you as well?
Definitely.
Because in fact, that's what we'll do. We'll open it up to all of our guests and they then can determine what the music is for the morning. What do you think, Zanati? You think it's a good idea?
Then the listeners sounds actually good. Shouted you then.
Yes. No, it sounds good. No,
and then what we'll do is we'll have a ballot system because...
I'm too sensitive for criticism. No. Now, Howard can take it. I can't.
Right.
I'm just making suggestions. That's
all. And I do want to be quite clear on some things as well, which I said during the, I do think that it is important in our age of democracy just to understand, and I say this at home as well, that not everything is. You know, when our children, I'm happy to hear their comments on many things,
yes.
But it doesn't mean they get a vote.
There's terminology for that.
Yes, it's not a democracy.
No, it's something better than that. It's called benevolent autocracy. So in other words, you don't mind what anybody does as long as it's done your way.
I think that sounds pretty much okay. Yeah. What do you think? So now we can go with that.
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, we're comfortable with that. Moshe says, Howard, I really like that intro to David Katz. This is really appropriate. You see, I can compliment as well, Moshe. That's from Moshe. Moshe, as much as I don't care for the criticism, nor do I for the compliment, but because I'm quite comfortable with our intros.
That's even-handed. You don't care for either. The compliments
absolutely.
Or the criticism. Brilliant.
There's certain things that one just doesn't necessarily... No. One doesn't necessarily... Anyway, time is 8:33. I'm Howard Feldman. This is your morning mayhem where we can just add another byline. Don't be confused. This is not a democracy. Right, David.
We've set the record straight.
Right, so in case there was any confusion.
Yes, absolutely.
There you have it. David, just before we go, I want to talk about your book today because I'm very excited that this week is the launch of your book and it is absolutely tremendous.
Yep.
I think it is a massive, massive achievement. It's a phenomenal book. We are going to be talking about that in just a few moments. But you were in the studio when we were talking to David Harris about these young women,
yes.
A young girl, in fact, of 15 who becomes radicalized. She runs off to join, ISIS in one form or another. She becomes a ISIS wife or bride. Whatever that means, and has children there. Now she decides that, there may be not enough satellite channels, whatever that would be, she now needs to return home to the cool, misty hills of England. Obviously, England, people in the UK saying, it's just not going to work this way. What are your thoughts on it?
Well, I think citizenship comes with rights and obligations. And so as a citizen of the UK, she's obviously entitled to rights. And not to take a phrase away from anywhere else, the right of return. I suppose she's entitled to come back.
But
she's got obligations.
Yeah, there are also laws about siding with an enemy.
Well, that's what I'm saying to you. I think some of the obligations need to come into play now, and also the family has certain obligations. There's a collective responsibility, I suppose, within the family to make sure that your kids behave within the society that you are living in. So I would say it's very problematic. But, certainly it's going to have to be dealt with from that point of view, that she hasn't met the obligations of her citizenship. So I don't know what the implications are for that or what the legal, but I mean, there's a moral problem here. Obviously, if you pack up, go off, fight for some a foreign organization that's anti the country that you come from, I think there's a problem.
And there have to be laws about that in terms of being a traitor to your own country. I mean, if you support, just going to directly onto your book, I mean, if you decided in South Africa that you were now supporting during the Second World War, you were going to support the axis of evil, the Nazis, certainly.
Well, the English have got precedent. I mean, James Joyce, Lord Haw, I don't know if you remember about him, he went over to Germany and he broadcast for Radio Zeezen, one of the German radio stations there, and he was captured in 1945, came back to England, was tried and sentenced to death for being a traitor. He wasn't involved in killing anybody, but he was a traitor. I mean, he broadcast to Germany, lived in Germany.
Do you see what they did to broadcasters and radio personalities back then, Zanati? They put them
playing the wrong music, singing the wrong tune.
I think some of our listeners would get behind that, actually. More than I'd like to imagine.
I think this is a threat.
That was a veiled threat to how you play the right music.
Wow. You see, you played the wrong music in 1944. By 1945, it was lights out.
It was game over.
Right. Wow. Absolutely fascinating. So you're thinking, your approach is they've got to be dealt with according to the law. So they should, if they want to come back, they come back and take their chances arriving at the airport.
I think so.
And whatever happens to them will happen to
them. Absolutely. Look, kids obviously have got UK citizenship. They're not guilty by association. So they're entitled, I think, to come back. And she, if she does decide to come back, must face the music.
She most certainly will lose her kids if she comes back to the United Kingdom.
Well, who knows how they'll treat her in this day and age? I'm not 100% sure. But like I say to you, I mean, if somebody can do this as a citizen, if somebody can go and fight for a foreign organization, that's hostile to the government where you come from. I mean, what message does it send out to the rest of the United Kingdom to be good citizens? It doesn't send the right message. So obviously there must be some punishment for.
And Renee, of course, saying, she was 15. How did she, how did she even do this? But I think that the ISIS system is a fairly sophisticated system in terms of giving false documentation and booking tickets. I think that
people are tried as adults for adult crimes. It's an adult crime. And I mean, she's not 15 now, is she? So she's had a chance. I mean, she's come back. She's not repentant in any way. I mean, didn't hear that.
No, certainly not. Where she says she's got no problem with beheadings. And she's actually had a very decent time.
If she came back and said, look, I was 15, naive, misguided, I made a mistake, and I'd like to come back and do whatever I have to do to be reintegrated to society, I think that's a different situation.
But, you know, David, without meaning to defend her, it must be very, very difficult, given her situation, to even get an outside perspective. Think about where she's living. She probably doesn't have access to a lot of media. I mean, she does, well, I guess she does now because she's being interviewed by Sky News. But if you think about it, she must be somewhat fearful of her life, for her life there, saying the wrong thing, etc. Even just indicating that she wants to leave would probably be a death sentence for her where she is. So, I guess that just making the decision to leave this cult, which I'm going to use the word loosely, might be something.
I don't buy into that because, I'll tell you why. Because the decision to go there couldn't have been an easy one. It's quite a brave, I mean, can I use the word brave? It's quite a brave decision to leave the green hills of England, and its twee little suburbs, and then go over to ISIL, and you know exactly what's going to happen there with the beheadings and everything like that. So that's a big decision. That's a hard decision taken by a hard person, they can make those type of decisions. So I don't buy that. I think she's got to come back and just face the music.
Right. Okay, I'd love your thoughts on it. 34519 or 061-895-1019. Please weigh in on this conversation. And this one, I am certainly open to a discussion. Let's talk about your book, David. It is finally being released. Well, it's actually not finally being released. It is released because I walked into Exclusive Books, and on the left-hand side is this whole yellow shelf of your books. It was amazing to see. I felt very, very proud. South Africans versus Rommel, the untold story of a desert war in World War II. Tell us about the process of writing this book.
Okay, look, it was quite a convoluted process. First of all, my education was quite convoluted. You do know I started off as a chartered accountant at Wits many, many years ago.
I'm really sorry to hear that.
The difference between a computer and an accountant is that the computer's got personality. So that's how I started. I got a bit of personality later in life, and I decided to do a military science degree at the Saldanha Military Academy. And I produced a thesis on the two greatest defeats that South Africa suffered during the Second World War, which was Sidi Rezaeg and Tobruk up in the Western Desert. And I decided I'm going to try and publish this as a book, my master's thesis. And it was bought overseas by Stackpole Books. They bought the rights to it, and they published it overseas in hard copy.
When was that?
2017.
Right.
And luckily for me, Jonathan Ball bought over the rights here to publish it in softcover, and which they did. So it became available to that. Where I really wanted it to be.
Well, it's relevant to South Africans. I mean, it is the South African story during World War II.
Of course it is, and I think it's an important story. So I'm absolutely delighted that they took it on, and they've done a fantastic job of advertising it and getting it out there on the shelves and mobilizing, you know, behind it. So that's absolutely fantastic. And I'm happy to say that it's gone for its second. It's gone for a reprint.
That is unbelievable.
No, it's unbelievable. After two weeks being sitting on the shelves, they're going to reprint. So I'm absolutely ecstatic. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. What's interesting to me is it's not a typical current South African book. If you look at the books that are written here in South Africa, it's very, very much about perhaps the struggle, our experiences through that, what is happening currently with ANC, with government. This is a book that takes us back into the end of 1930s, 1940s, etc. And that's quite unusual for a South African publisher to get behind a book like that, that doesn't feel that it is current reading for people.
I agree with you. I think what's filling the shelves now in the military history section of these shelves and exclusive books is the border war. There's a lot of concentration on the border war, people's memoirs. And it's a phase that history goes through. What happens after war, the first people to write about it are the participants at the lower levels, the people that actually fought in the trenches. And then what comes later is the reminiscences of the generals. And then you get the official histories coming
out. It's so interesting. Is that a standard thing? Is that kind of what happens?
It's usually what happens. That's a part. So we're looking, we're a very young stage of writing about the border war. I would be very hesitant, in fact, to write about the border war because people are still alive and the politics is still very much alive about it. And it's very emotional and sensitive.
I was going to say, we probably don't have the perspective that we need.
No, certainly we don't. And so what needs to come out on the border war now is an official history, because what happens with an official history is that official historians go in and get access to all the classified documents behind it. And they go and write an official history. And then along comes historians like myself who will go and use the official history as a foundation to now go and delve deeper,
right.
Yes, into the archives and then write a history. And that happens decades. And so it should happen decades after the event when people are long gone and there's no emotion attached. So hence now the book on South Africans versus Rommel. I think it's good timing. There was an official history that came out in the 70s, and since then nothing has really come out academically wise on that war.
Are South Africans conflicted about that? Not in terms of course the fact that we fought the Nazis, but in terms of where we were from a segregation point of view, from a colonial as a big, you know, part of the Commonwealth.
Even South Africans were even conflicted about fighting the Nazis. I mean, I think that's one of the themes in the book.
That
a large proportion of the country, I won't say backed the Nazis, but they were certainly anti-British. One of the few countries.
Well, we were one vote away, weren't we?
Well, we were very close to becoming neutral. Let's put it that way. So, Smuts managed to finagle something
correct.
In Parliament and he came in and we came in on the British side. But it was touch and go. So are you saying to me, is it a contested period? Certainly. I read yesterday in the Sunday Times, there was an article that the Department of Military Veterans is withdrawing their support for the Remembrance Parade on the SS Mendi. Last year they removed it from Delville Wood. And what is the excuse for saying they don't want to remember those black troops that went down with the Mendi? Is that it was an imperial war and they don't want to encourage history that has an imperial bent to it. So, even to this day, it's contested. So I bring this book out into a very historically contested area, and people are fighting for the relevance, and they're saying, "What is a usable history?" And most probably to a lot of people who are in government, this is not a usable history. This is not a history. Same as the Nationalists. The Nationalists didn't see our participation in the Second World War as being usable. And it was forgot under the Nationalist government from 1948 to let's say 1990. It was a forgotten history because the Nationalists didn't want to remember it. All of a sudden, just before the elections, words, they decided they're going to reinvigorate it.
In other words, it was obviously even decades later, it was still a source of discomfort for some of the more racist elements in the South African, on the South African landscape. The fact that South Africa fought the Germans.
Yes, absolutely. Surely it was. There's no doubt about it.
And it's actually interesting because now that you say it, when I think about the horrible history that we learned during at school, and you always had, you know, Zanati, we were talking about it the other day. Mm. You learned sort of Western or European history, which was the one side of it, yes. And then you learned South African history, which was breathtaking and mind-numbingly boring.
Yeah.
But more so than that was that we didn't even learn this stuff. We didn't learn at school how South Africa, we know that they participated on the side of the Allies, but that was kind of it. We didn't learn this kind of a detail. When I'm reading your book and I'm reading this kind of detail, I'm thinking, why is it that we just have never, and obviously we don't need to learn this kind of a detail at school, but we just don't know it.
Yeah. It didn't suit the agenda of the Nationalist government because, a large proportion of the Nationalist government in 1948 were pro-German when they came into power. And they were one of the only powers in the world that fought on the Allied side to come in and, with a pro-German government in 1948 after winning the war. And, there was a certain guy, Erasmus, who was a minister, who went about dismantling the links to the United Kingdom and dismantling the history of us fighting together with the United Kingdom. So we went through that process, and that's why today this is a very strange book to hit the shelves, because it's been through 50 or 60 years. It's under siege by most probably the present dispensation, but certainly the previous dispensation.
Really, really fascinating. I'd love your thoughts. 34519 or 0618951019. I'm chatting to Major David Katz, and we're talking about his book, South Africans versus Rommel, The Untold Story of the Desert War in World War II. And of course it is it's just been released, but there's book launches now. Benjamin says, Howard, I'm buying the book because my father was there. He was an infantry soldier. That's Benjamin. Benjamin, then come to the book launch. I'm going to be interviewing David at the book launch on Thursday evening. David, just give us those details.
It's on the 21st, Thursday evening, 6 o'clock. Be there. It's at the Book Dealers of Bluebird Center.
Mm-hmm.
That's near Melrose Arch, eh?
It's yes. So we don't need to panic because it's not that far from Melrose Arch. Everybody will be fine. It's just one center over. Bluebird Center. It's downstairs at the bookstore there. And do come and join us from 6 o'clock on Thursday evening.
And I think it's paired with some decent wine also.
Today's wine day. So how wrong can we go?
Can't go wrong.
8:48. We're going to come back to David in just one moment. Unsigned says, has the Major read a book called Written in Stone by Robbins? He documents Nazis and the national government alignment with them. For example, eugenics was experimented on by German experts on a tribe in the Karoo. I forget the town's name. David, are you aware of that book at all?
No, I'm not. I'm not actually.
You need to read it. It is absolutely fascinating. Letters in Stone. It is well worth
Great. Thank you for that heads up. I'll get hold of it.
Really, really a fascinating one. So, now the book is out and you're doing the launch. It is available exclusive and all all other major booksellers. Where to from here? Are you writing another book?
Yes, I'm busy doing a doctoral on Jan Smuts and his Great War. So that will.
That's your PhD.
That's my PhD.
Right.
And, there's interest in publishing that.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly that's my next project. Yeah.
There has just been a book on Jan Smuts, hasn't there?
Yes, Richard Stein has brought out three books on Jan Smuts, actually. In fact, I appeared.
Oh, but that's like showing off, really.
He's prolific, and I must tell you, there's a lot of interest. He's sold a fortune of books. Mm. I heard that he actually sold 20,000 books of his last, and that's a big sale.
His last book was, his last one, which is the only one I was aware of, was a very popular book. I kept picking it up, deciding whether to buy it and then putting it down.
I'm proud to say that I appeared with Richard Stein at the Funchik Literary Festival. On the same panel with me.
Right.
And we had a great discussion for about an hour. And, we touched, because he's a different type of historian to what I am. He's more journalistic. And, he deals mainly with the secondary sources. So what he doesn't really go into the archives or re-examine the documents. He more or less just takes the secondary sources that are out there and, he represents it.
So how will your book differ on it when you start looking into the Jan Smuts story?
Well, no, it's deep archival research. So in other words, I'm going to be going into the South African National Defence Force archives here that has a huge amount of stuff on the Great War. And also the National Archives in Pretoria that houses the Jan Smuts archives. There's 350 boxes of Jan Smuts letters and archives and everything that had to do with him. And then I'm off to the UK, it was probably in April, to go to the National Archives in the UK, which is an absolute fantastic place. I mean, it is just brilliant how they treat their archives.
Do they allow you reasonable access to it?
Absolutely. You've got to go and do a little course. You need to do a reader's course.
How to handle it.
It's just an amazing facility. It's unbelievable. So you do your reader's course. They give you a reader's card. And you go upstairs. And it's got three different sections. A section where you can talk, like me and you are talking. Mm-hmm. Then a section where you can whisper to whoever you're with, and then a quiet section.
Oh.
And then they've got...
That's scary.
That for you, that would be scary.
Can you imagine the quiet section?
No.
Yeah.
Wow.
But it's an unbelievable facility. They've got people walking around making sure that you touch they handle the documents correctly.
Well, I guess they have to. I mean, these are documents of national importance.
Absolutely. So I'll be visiting that and then the various universities to get private papers and that type of thing. So that's the difference between somebody writing from purely secondary sources and somebody drilling deeply down into the archives to come up with something new. You know, I want to bring something new to the table. I want to offer something that hasn't been spoken about before. And I think that's the difference. That's what I hope to do, is to present aspects of Smuts, the essence of the man, and present aspects of him that have not been covered before.
Absolutely wonderful. How long do you anticipate this will take?
Well, I hope my supervisor is not listening. I'm sure he is. But if I'm going to be handing in at the end of this year, so hopefully that will be the end of the thesis. And then to write the book out of that, because obviously a thesis is not a book. You've got to make it more presentable for the public.
It's got to be more readable. Absolutely.
It's got to be more readable. Yeah. So that'll take about another year. So what are we looking at? 2021 or something like that? Yeah.
The patience. It's unbelievable. I could never do that.
Got to have a very supportive family. Let's not forget the family.
Let's not forget the family.
Yeah.
Yeah. Absolutely fantastic. Well, David, best of luck.
Thank you very much.
I'm very excited about
it.
So looking forward to Thursday.
Mm-hmm. It's going to be fantastic.
All right. So if you do want to, do people need to let us know? They can just rock up.
I think they can just rock up. I know there's an RSVP on the invitation.
Yes.
But,
rock up. It's fine.
Just rock up.
I'll remind you on Thursday morning.
And there's snacks, I think, also. So,
Why did you just say so? This is a Jewish radio station. I mean, you don't have to be Jewish.
Come and see Howard Feldman, man. I mean, can't miss that.
There's a draw card, if ever there was one. It is 9 o'clock. You have a fantastic Monday. And, we will see you bright and early Tuesday morning.